I was going to prepare a joke for you today for Labor Day, but it was too much work. I've been waiting since the 4th of July for that. All right, we're going to do an investment class this morning. How many of you have investments of some sort? All right, I'm going to show you today how to double your investment in 2 seconds. If you can double your investment in 2 seconds, that sound pretty good? Ready for that? All right, here's how you do it. Get a $20 bill in your hand. Fold it. You have doubled your investment. And then the safest thing you can do with it, put it right back where you got it. Leave it alone. Happy Labor Day. Happy Labor Day. Did you know, this is serious now, did you know there's a new medical study out? You know they come out every other Friday on some subject, and most every other Friday they rescind what they said 2 Fridays before. That's usually the way. Are we drinking coffee this week or not? Given the medical studies, I never know whether I'm supposed to or whether it's bad for me. I'm not sure. But this is the new one. People who sit for 11 hours or more a day are 40% more likely to die over the next 3 years, regardless of whether they're physically active or not. Let me read that to you again. That was just almost too good to be true. This is true. This is a quote from a medical study. People who sit for 11 hours or more a day are 40% more likely to die over the next 3 years. Why are they sitting? It may be because they have a disease. But they didn't figure that. They're more likely to die over the next 3 years, regardless of whether they're physically active or not. Well, honey, if you're sitting for 11 hours or more a day, you're not very physically active. Thank you. Wow. Now, I got to give you the end of the study. Here's the end of it. In conclusion, this study says, in conclusion, prolonged sitting is a risk factor for all-cause mortality. Well, now there's a genius statement. Shorter sitting times and sufficient physical activity are independently protective against all-cause mortality, not just for healthy individuals, but for those with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, overweight, obesity. So all of us who are fat and crippled, get up and run. That's what it says. However, the researchers stressed, the findings don't necessarily prove that sitting killed people. How about a whole bunch of words that say absolutely nothing? There are so many caveats. I read that, I don't know, half a dozen times this week, just reviewing it. And as I did, it's like, you've got to be kidding. You just said, and then you took it back, and then you said it this way, and then you took it back. Make up your mind. That's medical studies. Labor Day. Anybody get a Labor Day card? Anybody wish you a happy Labor Day? Somehow or other, the card manufacturers have missed one. They've turned every other holiday into an opportunity to sell. But somehow or other, it hasn't happened for Labor Day. Last week we began, and I'm going to pick up on the theme this week. How did I tell you we tune an orchestra? How do you tune an orchestra? One simple thing. And A. Everybody tunes to A. With tuning fork, you can tune as many different pianos, instruments, whatever, because they all tune to that tone. Tuning to that tone is very important. It's critical in any organization, be it musical or otherwise. You got to get on the same page. You got to be tuned to the same tuning fork. You've got to be playing the same music. There is a study, and there may be someone in here who majored in this in college, called Myrmecology. Did anybody major in Myrmecology? See, that's not a Baptist thing. That's Murmurcology. There's two different things. This is Murmurcology. It's spelled M-Y-R-M-E-C-O-L-O-G-Y. Murmurcology. It's a real word. And it's a real study. It's the study of ants. It's the study of ants. People who study ants. Murmurcology. It's actually pretty fascinating. When I was a kid, I had an ant farm. Anybody else have an ant farm when you were small? And it was fun to watch them. And they're so industrious and pretty fascinating. Acting together, I don't know if you know it, but ants are one of the most dominant forces on land, period. They just are. They are individually equipped with unique strengths and capabilities. But what really makes them a force is how they work together. I hate fire ants. For me, hell will be strapped down to a fire ant mound. That's hell. And have you ever noticed that you never get one fire ant? Because by the time you have one, it's on you and it's biting, stinging, whatever it's doing to you that you're ouching, whatever that is. By the time you have one, you've got six, you've got 12, you've got 100. And it takes no time at all. Here's the reason. Not only do ants have a venom that they inject into you when they bite, but they also have a pheromone that they release when they do that that calls for reinforcements. So they're doing both at the same time. So the minute you're attacked by one, the cavalry's already on the way. That's ants. That's Myrmecology, the study of that. There is a particular type of ant in Central and South America that are about a quarter of an inch long, and their colonies contain up to 700,000 ants in a colony. In the early morning, thousands of the workers will pour out. Now, the drones, the workers, have no sexual organs, but their body is completely filled with this venom from top to bottom. And they will line up, quarter of an inch long, up to 45 feet across, and as much as 6 feet deep. And they begin in the morning and just start sweeping across the landscape. And as they encounter problems, each one of the workers will literally blow himself up for the food, for that which is there, and they will destroy anything that's in their path, working together. How did something so astonishingly small become so successful and so important? And the answer is, they're all tuned to do one thing, and one thing only, and they're not interested in their own way. They're not interested in their own personality. They don't have any excuses. They're just doing what they do, and they're eminently successful. No wonder Solomon told us to consider the ant. No wonder he said, take a look at these guys. You think you're insignificant. You think you can't get anything done. Look here. Consider the ant. I wonder, what would happen in a local church if we looked like ants? I wonder, instead of Myrmecology, if we really had Myrmecology, the ant study, and we functioned like that. What if we all combined our efforts to accomplish one thing with no agenda? I wonder what kind of an impact we would have if we operated as one. Well, I can tell you, the disciples did it with 11 guys in the New Testament, and they turned the known world upside down. It worked then. It still will. The only difference is we could do it a whole lot faster. With Christ as our head, it shouldn't be said in any other way other than our operational unit, the church, is not an individual matter, not my way, your way, his way, her way. It's A. And we're tuned in, and that's what we're doing. We've got one plan. Away we go. Proverbs 6. Check out the ant. By the way, Mike, that misreference of Scripture was not Becky's fault. That was mine. I gave her the wrong Scripture. Yes, I did. I sent you the wrong Scripture. My bad, okay? You're off the hook. It's actually Chuck's fault. Told you, Chuck, it's going to be a while. He that makes the whole body fit together perfectly, Paul said, as each part does its own special work, it helps the other parts grow. We've all got functions. We all do things really well. None of us can play the piano like Joseph does, but we sure would be lost without him. He adds so much to it. Could we live? Yeah. But would we be as well and as effective as we are without him? Of course not. When we get together, it makes the whole body healthy and growing and full of love. One of the things that I love about Pinnacle Church is y'all are a bunch of type A's. There's nothing worse than trying to pastor a bunch of type A's. All right, that's just reality. But what's fun is you have learned how to blend that together and work together. And it's fun to watch those things come to pass. God has always planned for us to work. He's always intended it. In Genesis chapter 2, on the seventh day, God entered into rest. He ended his work. He created. He's always been a worker. He created us in his image. And in the 15th verse of chapter 2, he took man, put him in the garden, and told him to tend the garden. Now, I will tell you that I was the little kid that was sitting over by the bench. I had never been good at tending the garden. I don't like to weed. I'm not interested in watching plants grow. I will eat the tomatoes and love them. But I am not good at tending the garden. So God had to do something outside the garden just for Dwayne. Otherwise, I would be sitting. Even from the beginning, God gave his work to me. When Jesus came to earth, his birth was told to the blue-collar guys, the shepherds. They were doing the night shift. They had the graveyard. They were the first one to learn of Christ's birth. The working person, Labor Day, has always been important to God. Joseph was a carpenter. He worked with his hands. Jesus grew up in his shop. Peter and Andrew, James and John, were fishermen, commercial. Matthew was a tax collector. The Bible doesn't say what Philip and Bartholomew and Thomas and the others did for a living, but they all had jobs because they had to eat. Safe to say. Jesus called them from their labors and called them to become fishers of men. And that's the generic form of men. He told his disciples in Luke chapter 10, remain in the same house, eat and drink such things as they give you, for the laborer is worthy of his wages, and do not go begging from house to house. Jesus was saying, I want you to work for what you get. You're entitled to it. You've earned it. Be worthy of it. And let them support you. Why do so many people think of work as being something bad? Because sin has entered the world and caused work to be unpleasant. Go back to Genesis again. Adam speaks and says, because you have heeded the voice of your wife, and you have eaten from the tree, which I commanded, saying, don't eat it. Cursed is the ground for your sake, and you shall eat of it all the days of your life. When sin entered the world, God cursed the ground and said, that which was going to be easy, now you're going to have to work for it. And it's not going to be easy. The weeds will grow right along with the fruit. Adam enjoyed tending the Garden of Eden until it changed because of sin. We think of work as a necessary evil. Well, it's Monday. Got to go to work. Here we go. Instead of, thank God I have an opportunity to go to work. Most of us see work as something we ought to do as little of as possible. And we're always trying to get more money for less work. Always. And that leads to the idea of somebody else doing it for me. In America, labor and management have become enemies. Labor is looking for a bigger piece of the pie. Management says it's a zero-sum game. So there is this back and forth that goes on. How many of you, when you were a kid, had chores to do at home? Do you have chores? Okay. Have you noticed that most kids today don't do chores? That's part of what's wrong with our culture. My allowance, did you get an allowance when you were a kid? My allowance was I got to live there next week. That was my allowance. My dad had a store, and if I wanted money, I had to go work for it. But my chores around the house, that was for room board. That was not optional. There was no discussion about that. There was no, well, this week I'm going to do that. What never even came up. Chores. I believe in it. I really do. I think they help shape a personality and give an ethic. We're raising a generation that doesn't want to work anymore, and you see it now in our politics, and you see it in the workforce, and everything that's coming along with it. For those of you that are employers, I would remind you that slavery has been abolished. Treat your workers with respect, and they will work for you like crazy. Be a slave driver, and they may finish the task. I'll put the period right there. There's a relationship that goes with that. Being an employer is an honored position, and slavery has long since been abolished. God cares about how we conduct our business, how we treat others. Don't forget, we're tuned to A. Don't forget, what we do is not just for our bread on the table. It's to represent His kingdom and represent how He would do it. It's a very good thing to say, what would Jesus do? How would He handle this? That matters. I wear these bracelets around on my arm. You know why I wear them? The purple and white one is Lauren's. She made that. And it's the one that's obviously closest to my heart. It will always be the one that's furthest up my arm. But this is to remind me to pray. The one in the middle says, I love Sundays. Guess what I'm praying about? Been at the church. And the black one that's down there close to my wrist I got last week, that's Roger Priebus. He's going to have surgery on the 8th for glioblastoma also. And so that's to remind me to pray. These are my prayer reminders. That's why I wear them on my arm. I mean, I know they're fashionable and they look great on me. I get that. But they actually have a purpose. It's to remind me to pray. That keeps me tuned to A. All the time I'm reminded. And when I'm wearing these around and I'm in a store, a little girl over at Office Depot saw the I Love Sundays one particularly, and she said, I want one of those. And I said, baby, we've given them all away. She said, well, get some more. I want one. All right, so I have this on. It says I Love Sundays. This says Pray for Roger. Purple white one is Lauren. So how am I going to represent myself in public? If I go act like an idiot, and I'm mean, and I'm all those things, and folks out there who are unbelievers, they see me, and they see this on my arm, it's incongruous, it doesn't work. This helps keep me tuned to A. It's a silly little thing, but it reminds me what's important. Money is not an option. Let me ask you a question. If you have a job that needs to be done and you decide that job's worth $100 a quarter, that's what it's worth to do a particular job around your house. It's worth $125 to get it done. And one guy comes and he offers to do it for $150, and the other guy comes along and he offers to do it for $100. How much should you pay for getting the job done? $125. Because that's what you decided the job was worth. It wasn't what can you get it done for. It was, what's it worth? Yesterday I was on the phone for a very long time. Yesterday as I was coming back up from Houston with a young man who came to give me some help when I needed to move a sofa. And he's got 8 kids. And they're about to lose their house. And I talked to him for several hours. 3, to be specific. About where to go, what to do, how to handle it, and where we go from here. And the reason he called me was all I had him do was help me pick up a sofa and move it about 6 inches. And I didn't tell him how much I would pay him, but I had already figured out what I thought it would cost to get that done. We got done, and it might have taken us 45 seconds to do it. And when we got done, I handed him a $50 bill. And he said, this is way too much money. And I said, That's what the job is worth to me. And I gave him $50. Well, I found out yesterday how much that $50 meant. I had no idea at the time. But I found out that that meant more than $50. It was a witness to. And he had been raised in church when he was a little kid. But he'd been away from it for a very long time, and he's gone through all a lot of stuff. Gone a lot of places wish he hadn't gone. And now he's trying to figure out what to do with his life. And I'm trying to get him back in tune with Ed. And it all started because there was a job that was worth $50. All I'm saying to you guys is that's what it means to be a Christian and to be consistent. Jesus says, whatever you want men to do to you, do that for them. Treat them that way. If you can get by with shoddy work somewhere along the line, then we'll come back to you. One of my very favorite sayings in life is, what goes around, and it does, every single time. What you put out there will come back. Paul said to the Colossians, whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord, and not to men. Knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of inheritance, you serve the Lord Christ. So your rewards are for doing a good job. On Labor Day, our job is to be His church and to do a good job in this community, representing the gospel, not representing a program, an idea. We're representing Him. We're tuned to A, one symphony. I don't know if you remember anything about World War II history, but in World War II, the USS Astoria was the first United States ship to encounter the Japanese fleet and to have a firefight. And it's on August the 9th of 1942. And the first ship that they encountered was a huge ship in Japan, the Japanese fleet, the Chikai. And it was a nighttime firefight. And the Astoria did serious damage to the Chikai, but they also took several hits. And one of the hits that they took was to one of the 8-inch gun turrets. And if you know anything about how the ships were put together, when that turret blew up, the young man who was in that turret and running that gun was blown into the water. His name was Elgin Staples. Elgin was from Akron, Ohio. And he was just a young seaman third class. He was nobody. He was just a sailor. But it blew him in the water. And the Astoria took serious hits, would ultimately sink. But while he was in the water, the USS Jackson came by and picked him up, took him back to the Astoria. And the captain was trying to save the ship, and he thought, well, maybe if I can beach the ship, we can save her. So he tried to beach the ship, but took two more hits before he could get the ship to the beach. And Staples was thrown back into the water. So now he's been thrown off that ship and into the water twice. He has one safety belt on. It's like a life belt around his waist. That's the only thing he had to save his life. And he was severely wounded in his legs. He spent the next 3 days in the water because the captain couldn't get the Astoria up to the beach and it sunk. When it sank, there was no boat to go back to. So he had to wait for another ship to come along to pick him up. And it finally happened, and he was picked up. When he was returned to the naval base, they decided that he'd earned a little leave time. So they put him on an airplane, and they sent him home to Akron to just recover, just have a little time to regroup. So when he got home, his mom and he were sitting down, and they were talking. And he was telling her the story, of course, of what it was like to be in the water, scared of sharks, and bleeding, and all the things that went with it. And you know how he can always tell mom the story in such a case, she's just going to sit there and cry. You know, we boys know how to do that with our moms, get their attention. And so he told the story as scary as he possibly could. And he said, Mom, he said, the only thing I had that saved my life was this life belt that I had around my waist. And she said, oh, he said, I owe my life to that lifeboat. She said, those are made by Firestone. During the war, Firestone stopped making tires, or along with making tires, they started making some safety equipment, and they made that lifeboat. He said, really? It was made here in Akron? And she said, yeah, we made those. And he said, well, that's amazing. He said, there's a number that's stamped on that lifeboat. He said, I memorized that number. I had it. And he said, it's all I had to do when I was in the water for that period of time. And he rattled off whatever the number was. It was six digits, 236-481. I don't know. It was a number. And he rattled it off to her. And she said, well, those are numbers that Firestone puts on those belts so they know who made it. It's a quality control thing. That way they know who made the belt. He said, well, the number was, and again, he just rattled off the number because he had it memorized. And she stopped, and she looked at him, and she said, what was that number? And he gave it to her again, and she said, that's my number. Now, when she was making that belt, that was just a belt. That was just a job. And it might have been on Thursday, Tuesday. They were coming down the assembly line, and she was putting them together and stamping her number on it. Do you suppose it mattered to her at that point that she had done a good job? Do you suppose it was important? No, you never know when something you do, some little service that's routine, just might make the difference in somebody's life. Consider the ant. They're pretty insignificant. We don't think of them as being terribly important, but they are the most significant force together on the planet. Wow. What a picture for the church. God's number is stamped on you. Perfection. He made you. Don't let somebody that needs you down. Don't forget to be who God called you and put you here to be. And do your job the best you can possibly do. Always. Because you're representing